Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And today on Maltin on Movies, we are very happy to welcome Paul Walter Hauser, who...
And we battled for this. I have been trying to get you for a long time. And because we just interviewed Dennis Lehane, I begged the nice publicist working on Blackbird to see if you had any free time. Because we're really big fans of yours and we wanted to talk to you.
This is worth making time for. I'm a big fan of your dad. And now next time I get on the treadmill, I got to download this podcast and listen. This is really cool.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Paul Walter Hauser is building an incredible career. He is right now starring with Taron Egerton in a superior 6-part creepy
creepy's the word
miniseries called Black Bird, based on a true story.
Yeah,
about a well, how do I sum that up?
Well, I can do it for you because
I'm sure you can.
Black Bird is a 6-part limited series based on a true story, written by Dennis Lehane, who famously wrote the books Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, Shutter Island, etc. And this is a dark, character-driven tale that weaves a lot of psychological drama and it's true crime adjacent, in which we follow Jimmy Keene, played by Taron. Jimmy is doing a 10-year stint because of everything from drug pushing to weapons charges. And then he's given an out. You can forego the remaining 8.5 years of your sentence if you go to this maximum security prison full of whack jobs and infiltrate this guy, Larry Hall, get a forced confession from him to keep him behind bars and to stop his appeal. And you end up saving lives and saving your own in the process. So that is where we set these two characters. I play Larry Hall, the killer in question, who they're trying to keep behind bars.
So you've done this before then?
I had a personal training session this morning and I had some pre-workout and some caffeine. So I'm ready to go. I'm ready to live and die for this podcast, you know?
That's awesome.
Boy. Not everybody comes podcast ready.
I mean,
you know, to these sessions.
I mean,
no, I showed up, or I'm trying.
You're ready to go.
Which is amazing because you are, as we all know, an overnight success story. Another one of the
okay, we love to, just to be clear, because obviously you can't see us in person. That's a joke.
10-year yeah. Overnight success.
Our favorite thing always is when you do overnight success. I'm like, I saw them for the first time 26 years ago. Where were you? You know, it's hilarious. And obviously you've been working, you've done a lot of short films and you've written and directed them too, which is very cool. And you know, so to me, when I see that, what that means is that you love doing this and you enjoy doing this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say a quick resume of the origin of how I got here is I grew
Don't
up.
Don't be quick. We're here for your whole origin.
I grew up in Michigan, one of four kids to parents who are like Protestant ministry workers, you know, pastor and teacher. And they, you know, they kind of brought me up on more classical fare. It's a Wonderful Life and It's Sound of Music and Grease and just kind of like, you know, Wizard of Oz family films. And somewhere in the early 90s to mid 90s, I get really into all these comedians. I'm falling in love with Jim Carrey and Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber. I'm falling in love with Robin Williams, the voice of the genie in Mrs. Doubtfire. I'm falling in love with Martin Short in a wacky movie like Clifford, and then a wacky character in a more traditional film like Father of the Bride. Mm-hmm. So everybody from Daniel Stern to Chris Farley, these men were kind of my breeding ground for learning that you can get a laugh by pratfalling. You can get a laugh by making an exaggerated Commedia dell'arte-esque facial expression. You can get a laugh by overcommitting to something and almost playing drama within the sphere of comedy. So bringing in that environmental drama to an environment of comedy, that commitment level becomes a big part of the laugh. And I just fell in love with those guys and studied them and loved them. And then I think in the late 90s, early 2000s is when I discovered James L. Brooks, Sidney Lumet, Martin Scorsese, Christopher Guest, Rob Reiner. And I got really obsessed with movies like Waiting for Guffman and Serpico and, Stand By Me and stuff. So it was this place of always loving to perform, loving comedy, but then discovering drama in my teen years and deciding, wow, I want to be like Paul Giamatti or Phil Hoffman or John C. Reilly, where you get to do a little bit of everything. And then on the side, maybe I'll make these small intimate films like Edward Burns or, you know, best case scenario, get to do what Rob Reiner does, where in the same breath you do a Spinal Tap, you go do, Princess Bride or something, you know? So that was always the trajectory. And I think I'm halfway there. I think I'm getting the acting thing down well, but it is my full on intention to do a great, meaningful directorial debut with great mastery of tone and entertainment value and do what Bo Burnham did with Eighth Grade or what Greta did with Lady Bird.
Well, wow. Paul.
First off, good on you.
Yeah.
As the Aussies say.
This is so fantastic, but you and I are right around the same age and everyone that you're talking about, it's the same thing. And I love Chris Farley and a lot of people just think that he's funny. He's ridiculous. He does these things. I grew up obsessed with those David Spade movies, you know, and the reason being that if you really watch, you see how deep Chris Farley goes. And if you don't love him, you know, if you don't feel what other people feel, then the comedy stuff is fine, but it doesn't work. So even in those really ridiculous, him falling over, one of my personal favorites is that guy in a little coat. So funny, but you love him. And it kills me that he's gone because I really think we would have seen so much, but that's
thanks for bringing that up. I got him tattooed on my arm. I literally have.
Really? That's awesome.
All my comedy heroes from childhood.
Wow.
It goes Martin Short. It's Martin Short, Daniel Stern, Chris Farley, Jim Varney, Jim Carrey, Robin Williams.
That's amazing.
Wow. Those are my guys. And Farley, you know, what's great is younger actors ask for advice sometimes.
Sure.
And when they do ask me, I usually tell them two things. One, you got to go create your life outside of the business and outside of the ambition and hustle. Find your hiking trail, find your church, find your movie theater, find your favorite burger. You got to have a life. If this is just your life, you will finally make it and you'll still feel empty and that'll suck. So don't do that. The second thing I tell them is any good actor has to have love. There's got to be love and empathy. In my opinion, you can still be a movie star and be loveless or empathetic or non-empathetic, but you can't be a great actor.
True.
And there is a difference. So with Chris Farley, he had heart in the biggest of ways.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was he didn't. It superseded his love for himself.
And that's
the best way to love oneself is to kind of protect yourself and make choices in your own self-interest for mental and physical health. And unfortunately, addiction is a disease that got him and my other hero, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Those are my two guys. I don't look to Brando and Meryl Streep, even though I think they're brilliant. My people are Chris and Phil, you know, and they're both gone, regrettably.
I, I got to meet, I love Philip Seymour. I've had a crush on Philip Seymour Hoffman since I was a kid. And I got to meet him once in Telluride for the film festival. And he was exactly as awkward as I thought he would be, like not prepared for me to be like, oh, I tried really hard not to just like, I love you so much. He was in the corner in this with this black beanie on, just like as small as he, and I was like, I just want to tell you that I love you and that you're super talented and you're great. And he's like, well, thanks, man. And it was, it's the kind of, those are the people, again, you just want to protect them. But it's so interesting. You talk, even Jim Carrey's another example of this, where growing up, he was this wild, crazy, but then you would see, like, he's, you know, he's in Simon Birch and he, it's a small role, but it was one of his first dramatic roles. And it was like, oh, wow. See, that's, he's hilarious.
There's more there.
But you love him.
Yeah.
You know?
So, Paul, you have played so many, shall we say, odd.
Unique.
Characters.
Yeah, that's true.
Not the least being the current one.
Yeah.
Who you inhabit so brilliantly and so convincingly. So that's the thing.
Yeah.
We don't see you acting.
No.
We just see this guy. That's all the difference in the world between putting on a performance and inhabiting a character.
Yeah.
How do you do that? But how do you not let that overtake you while you're shooting?
The best way I could describe it is, acting is sometimes sort of just like surviving, where, you know, some of us are not very athletically gifted, but if you're in a life-threatening situation, you're falling off a cliff, you might be able to do a pull-up like you can't do in a gym.
Right. So,
acting for me is sort of, not all the time, but sometimes it becomes this life-threatening situation where if you didn't want to get caught telling the truth, you'd become a good liar. If you didn't want to fall off a cliff, you'd become a good athletic pull-up person. So for me, Larry Hall, it's just, you got to overcommit and you got to believe what you're doing and kind of fearlessly trust yourself and not look to everybody else. And here's why that's hard for me is I've spent my whole life trying to people please and get people to love me and get approval. And that's a pretty universal thing for most of us. But for me, I've had to really shed that and trust myself. You know, Taron Egerton pulled me aside early on in the shoot, about a month in. He said, this is our set. You and I are running the show. This is our show. And I thought maybe he had a couple drinks in him and was just saying it. But he really meant it. And I had never taken ownership on a character with such authority and sort of poise and self-belief as I did of Larry Hall. Previously, I've always felt like a guest on every set, where I still feel like the kid who's sharing a bedroom in an apartment building trying to get ready for pilot season. You know, I still feel like and that's not true. And I've had to kind of recognize that and get better at that. So to play Larry, I really think more than anything, to inhabit, as your dad so appropriately put it, I think inhabitance is all about falling back in your, you know, trust falling on yourself is what I would refer to it as.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then how does your director help you at a moment like that?
Not much. I didn't really get any, you know, this and Richard Jewell are the two projects I'm most proud of from an acting standpoint of what I've gotten to kind of do or achieve. But on both those projects, I was basically not really directed at all. That doesn't mean it means I think I know how to drive the car. I just need to know I need the director to tap me on the shoulder and tell me what the speed limit is, or tell me that, or remind me that there's a curve coming up and I may need to decelerate, you know.
That's
the direction I get on set when I'm at my best. When I'm at my worst is when someone's trying to micromanage
and tell me
who the character is. And then in the moment, I'm so obsequious and people pleased that I'm going to do what they want rather than what I know to be true. And that's, you can take that out of acting and put that in any facet of life. If you ignore your gut instinct to please some random person, that usually doesn't go well. Having said that, I talked to Michael Shannon once after a screening of 99 Homes. I love that movie.
Great movie.
And Michael's one of my favorite actors. I've gotten to meet him once or twice and hope to work with him someday. And he, you know, I told him, I said, I was on the set of a show where I did this character in the show called Kingdom. And there was this
I love Kingdom, and you're great in it.
Thanks. That was my first kind of, you know, thing.
I know.
But the problem was, is I had a scar that I had shaved into the side of my head for the character in the pilot. And that scar was supposed to signify child abuse. I had a bottle broken over my head in a foster home when I was a kid. And so that scar meant something to me. And by the second or third season, I forget which, I had a director and producer kind of tell me, we're not going to do the scar in the head. We're going to omit that. And I was like, well, that's a lack of continuity. That's something and they're like, well, we're not going to do it. And I was just like, and I bucked against it a little bit. And my good buddy and scene partner, Matt Loria, kind of looked at me like, what are you going to do?
Mm.
And I chose to relent, and it hurt my feelings deeply. To this day, I regret it, and I'm annoyed by it. I've forgiven those guys. It's not like I harbor any resentment. It's whatever. It's a small little thing. It doesn't matter. But I bring it up as an example to say that I'm now at the point in my career where I can't be told that anymore, you know, unless maybe it's Spielberg or Tarantino, but even that I might pull them aside and go, I know you made Jaws, but I'm about to make you this character.
Right.
So the respect is a two-way street, you know?
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say Michael. So again, Michael Shannon, it's ridiculous. Right. But I think that something that you two share very much is that because people, like, obviously, when you get onto a show like Kingdom, you haven't done 8,000 talk shows. We haven't seen MTV Cribs, you know, so people are introduced. They're meeting you exactly how you present.
Yeah.
So they don't know. They don't know who you are. They don't know. Is this how you are? Are you shy in real life? But you know what I mean?
I know exactly. I had people. Jonathan Tucker told me he had people in his friend and family circle coming up to him saying, is that guy mentally impaired? Does he really have autism? Does he, like, whatever the thing was. And then I would meet them and they'd almost be like surprised that I could, I don't know, crack a joke or talk about foreign policy or quote, whatever. See, and it was very funny though, to engage in that way. And I think I'm past that now, but it is fun to kind of have the anonymity of being known as an actor, not a star. And then it's easier to pull that stuff off. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis did that his whole life.
Exactly.
Because he wasn't doing, you know, he wasn't jumping rope on Ellen. You know what I mean?
And
there's a price to pay for that kind of exposure.
Well, that's Michael Shannon, who often plays terrifying characters, intense characters. You know, he can do anything, obviously, but he was on, it's really funny, but he was on an episode of whatever the karaoke show is. The one that, that LL Cool J hosts, you pretend, and he got up there and I found, he's a punk kid, you know, he was into REM and all those. So he gets up and he does a performance of End of the World as We Know It. And I was just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever, him jumping around in a t-shirt, just mouthing the words. And I was like, this is part of what makes him so magical.
It's a lip sync thing.
It's lip sync battle. Sorry. That's what it's called. Lip sync battle. Yeah. My bad.
But forgive me. I interrupted you. You said it was cool to see because of the sort of code switch or the dichotomy? Is that what you're getting at?
All of it. It's the idea that you don't know what he's going to do.
Oh,
and when he gets up there, does it surprise me that he's giving it his all? Not in the slightest. But there's something wonderful about that. And I think that as people discover you, part of what made Richard Jewell so special was my favorite part was seeing you go to all the different award shows. There's a great picture of you and one of my publicist friends smoking a cigar. And I was like, yeah, that's the whole idea, is that he can do anything. And so, you know, you'll play a part where you're fast and quick. You could be a lawyer. You could be whatever you want. But the audience is going to go, okay, great. Now what? You know?
Well, that's cool. Thank you.
Well, to have a bag of tricks that has no bottom.
Yeah. It's fun.
Is great. Now, when Clint Eastwood cast you
when in, Clint in the
leading,
Eastwood
the leading role of Richard Jewell.
You're right, right.
I can't imagine what went through your mind. But knowing Clint, which I do a little bit, I'm not shocked that you say you got no direction.
Well, you know, he really trusts his actors, and he, you know, from what I observed, his brilliant camera operator, who's borderline like a cinematographer, really, mm-hmm. this guy, Steve Campanelli, who actually directed his own film. I forget the title, but look up Steve Campanelli. He did a movie a couple of years ago that was brilliant. Campanelli will always do like a rehearsal, and they'll shoot the rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like take one. Really, it's just, and I'm not finding it. Everybody's finding it. You know what I mean? And sometimes Clint is like satisfied with that. And you know, it's like, okay, well, let's do the real one. So I would say between 2 and 3 takes is what happened most of the time. Everybody thinks that Clint is one and done. That's not fully true, you know, especially on the film I did with him. And mind you, I don't know if this is true. This is just what his producers told me. But they said that I was the only actor who was ever starring in a Clint Eastwood movie who got more than 1 or 2 takes.
I think that's true.
Part of me wondered, is that a bad thing? Does that mean I suck that much that I needed my 5 takes? But you know, I...
No, well, I don't think it's a bad thing.
Sean didn't get it on Mystic River, and he wanted it. Leo didn't get it on J. Edgar.
And he wanted it.
So I'm grateful that I think the performance also turned out a little better because they gave me, you know, 3 or 4 swings at the plate, which I'm just being honest, like, you're not going to get my best stuff if you give me 1 or 2. You just won't. You might get home earlier to watch your favorite show or have dinner with your whoever, but it's, you're not going to make a better movie. So, you know, that scene at the end of the film where I'm crying while eating the donut, you know, I asked Clint, I said, I'm going to need like 6 to 10 cracks at this or whatever. I need you to overshoot it more than you normally would. And he did, to his credit. He shot the hell out of it. And I think we did 9 or 10 takes from 3 different angles, probably 3 per angle about. And, you know, Clint claims, and he told me this, I still don't believe it, but he claims that the take he used in me crying in the film is like the first one I did. I was like, I don't know if that's true.
He's pretty straightforward. I don't know that is an incorrect.
maybe I just have trouble believing it. But yeah, no, that movie was such a blessing to me, and it, you know, I had a meeting at Fox years ago in 2017 or 2018 where I said to the development executive there, "Are you still doing the Richard Jewell movie?" He said, "Yeah, we're doing it with Jonah and Leo." I said, okay, well, if Jonah ever drops out, I hope you'll consider me.
Mm.
The exec kind of smirked at me and gave me, not belittling me, but kind of saying like, that's sweet. Yeah, no, we'll see. I like you and I, Tanya kid, but we're not going to let you star in this movie type of a thing. And then 2 years later, I was getting the offer, or a year and a half later, I got the offer from Clint.
Amazing. Amazing. Crazy. Now you've worked twice with Spike Lee.
Yeah,
love. You madman.
And tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I went into audition for Black Klansman the day after I came back from the Toronto Film Festival for I, Tonya. Spike had not seen I, Tonya or watched it or knew about it. But I had a lot of confidence after that weekend.
I'll bet.
So I walked into the audition. There's a lot of great, you know, younger white male actors going in for these racist piece of crap roles. And I go in, and I just wrote like a mini monologue at the end where I was like, I'm going to go in, and if I have the chutzpah, I'm going to read or perform this bit that I wrote at the end that I think the character would say. That's already kind of a scary thing to do, because Spike Lee is a great writer. The guy wrote Do the Right Thing, for goodness sake. So he could become very offended. So I just wanted to take the temperature in the room. And when I got in the room, before I did the first scene, I punched myself in the head a couple times. Not incredibly hard, but probably a 5 out of 10 punch. And Spike goes, what was that? Hold up, bro. What was that? And I said, I got to put the dummy in my skull before I play this character. And he goes, do that in the scene. Just add it in the scene. So I put it into the scene at one point where I hit my head while talking to the Adam Driver character. And I could just tell he was kind of vibing on me, like kind of looking at me with a little smirk, like he knew something I didn't. And then in the second scene, we did a second take. And at the end, I did the thing that I wrote, which is I said, boys, the good book says the tongue is a sword. We don't really use swords anymore. Well, what do we use? We use guns. We use bullets. What is a bullet? But a little itty thing that dunks you on the head. I was like telling the David and Goliath story through a bullet. Like, we're going to defeat Goliath with a tiny stone, which is a bullet. And Spike got really into it, and he goes, say you're going to bust those mother effers heads in. I go, we're going to bust those mother effers heads in. We're going to paint the town red. It's just not going to be our red. And Spike just yells and goes, sit down, man. And he goes, where are you from? What movies do you watch? What do your parents do? It's like, he was very hyped up, and I knew he saw that I was doing what I do, which is trying to do the text and do the job, but bring my own thing to it. And sure. he took down my cell phone number in the meeting, which I've never had a director.
No, certainly not Spike. Like, no, that's
yeah. And the moment he took my cell phone number down, and then we bro hugged, and I walked out of the meeting, and I'm a spiritual dude. And so the moment I walk out, I go, God, if I don't get that part, I'm going to effing kill someone. I said it like, as if to, not that I ever would, but as if to say, like, that was the greatest audition I've ever had in my life. If I don't get that, what's the point of ever auditioning?
Yeah.
And true to form, they cast somebody else, but they said, can you play the sidekick to the lead villain? And so I did that. And at the premiere of Black Klansman in LA, Spike pulled me away from my agents and managers. And he goes, take a walk with me. He puts his arm around me. I have a photo of this. He puts his arm around me. He goes, you really did a great job in this movie, man. I said, oh, thank you, man. And he goes, we're going to work together again. And I said, well, if you need another scary, stupid white guy, I got you. And he goes, no, I'm not going to make you play the same thing every time. He goes, you're better than that. Took a picture of me, hugged me. And it was a really cool, weird moment where it felt like your godfather or your uncle taking you aside or something. And sure enough, Christmas Eve of 2018, I'm talking like 4 months later, I got a phone call from Spike while I was sleeping at my parents' house in the guest bedroom. And I was dead asleep, and I woke up, you know, I probably drank the night before and woke up at noon, and I tried sounding all chipper, like, oh, hey, Spike, what's going on, man? And he goes, where are you at? And I go, Saginaw, Michigan. He goes, Saginaw. It took me 3 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. You know what that's from? I go, Simon and Garfunkel, the song America? He goes, yeah. So listen, man, I'm shooting a movie in Vietnam and Thailand for 2 months, March and April. I'm going to send you a script. Get ready. And then, like, hangs up. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And true to his word, the next day, Christmas Day, I saw what did I see? I went to the theater to see The Mule and Green Book with my parents. And in the middle between movies, I stepped out of the theater and saw he texted me the script for The Five Bloods. That night, I went down to my parents' basement, turned all the lights off, lit a candle, and read the script front to back twice in a row. And said, I get to go on another adventure. Here we go.
Well, man. That's, you know.
And so you're not only in two Spike Lee films, you're in two exceptionally good Spike Lee films.
Wow. And that's just the luck of the draw and the blessings from God. I can't believe I'm in two really, really powerful movies he made of all the ones he could have made. And I gotta backtrack and just say to any young actors listening, or I say young, any actor listening who feels discouraged, I saw The Mule Christmas Day of 2018. 1 year later to the day, I was watching Richard Jewell in theaters on Christmas Day.
Ah.
So it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
The craziest of the crazy can happen. You can go see a Noah Baumbach film, you know, and then a year later be working with Noah. Like, that stuff happens.
It does. Well, and that's being prepared, being ready for that, and also understanding how much you want to give to everything. You know, it makes a difference. It really does. Yeah. And, you know, you were saying, you know, being in an apartment building during pilot season, that's what I grew up. My running joke, because I grew up here, is I had friends who would be here for a couple of months at a time, and then they'd leave again. So it was almost like birds flocking, you know, a home that they go back for the winter and come here for. Mm-hmm. It was a crazy thing to see all these young people schlepping from God knows where with their aunts and grandmothers and everybody else.
To the Oakwood Apartments.
To the Oakwood Apartments, which is called something else now.
We should explain, which was the go-to place for temporary housing.
I've watched the Hollywood Complex, the documentary about Oakland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was 15, 16 years old, and all these young people, as I say, coming from all over and moving here and doing this and going to auditions. And I mean, even just trying to understand the rejection, I don't think people fully understand what that is, and that you can do a ridiculous number of auditions and get rejected. And that's why I have the greatest respect for folks who follow it and continue on with it and move from all these different places.
Well, and you got to remember too, I mean, and I know we're talking about Hollywood stuff, but like, think of all the people who work as hard as any actor does, but they don't have award shows or parties with open bars or magazine articles. It's like, on my worst day, I have to remember to consciously humble myself and realize, do you know, my buddy Danny Joe, who's like a mentor and personal trainer for me, he said to me the other day, he goes, your worst day, someone would still kill to be you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's such wisdom that I try to take hold of, you know.
It's true. Now, a lot of people saw you or remember seeing you for the first time in I, Tonya, which is a great part. But again, it's a great part.
The wardrobe alone.
The way you play it, it's a great part. And so much of that film has to do with tone.
Mm.
The tone of the film. And Craig Gillespie, that's sort of his strong suit, it seems to me.
I said the same thing to him other night. The other night he came to my house. I had a listening party for this hip-hop EP I put out. I make rap music under the name Signet Ringer. And he and his wife were kind enough to drop in and hang out for a bit. And I told him, I was like, you're a master of tone, man. Like, you know how to do the most specific thing. And that movie could have been awful, but Steven's script combined with Craig's precision and everybody falling in line and saying, we're making this movie. We all know what movie we're making. I mean, that I was so proud. I'm still so proud of that movie. We're coming up on the 5-year anniversary this autumn. And I look back on that, and that was such a big moment for me. Not that anyone knew my name. I didn't get nominated for anything. It wasn't about that. It was about people going, oh, who's this guy? He's holding his own with everybody else, but we don't know him. And, you know, that's how I felt about Riz Ahmed when I saw Nightcrawler.
Sure.
I thought, this guy's as good as Jake Gyllenhaal. And I really like Jake Gyllenhaal. Who's this guy? You know, there's something so fun about that, you know?
But it's the discovery. So I love Kingdom and everyone in it. I've been a Jonathan Tucker fan since I was a kid.
He's so good, man.
He's so good.
That guy should be much bigger than he is. I get very frustrated by that.
I've been a fan for years, and I've gotten to meet him to tell him just how brilliant I think he is, because he is. Mm-hmm. But everybody on that show is so good. But there's that scene where you walk in on Mallory having sex. That's the one that lives rent-free in my head. It's just this great moment. He and this girl are having what we'll call rough sex outside. And Paul just walks into frame, and Mallory looks at him and is like, not now, man. This is not a good time. And he sort of just goes, sure. Yeah. It's a great, ridiculous moment.
That was a fun job. You know, I went in as a co-star, like an under five line type of role, they call it. I just remember thinking, this guy's in a halfway house. He's kind of a weirdo. I'm really going to own this. And I put like a sliver or piece of wood in my shoe. I had these slippers, and I said, this guy, even when he's sitting, needs to be uncomfortable. So at all times I was doing that, and I was punching my femur and giving myself Charlie horses between takes. I was flicking the back of my ear like this, like a kid does in a classroom setting, so that when they yelled action, I would stop, but I'd feel the residue of abuse. Huh. People who have been abused, even when they're not being abused, there's that residue.
Yeah. And
I treated this tiny part, like I always tell actors, I treat the scrimmage like it's a Super Bowl. Treat the scrimmage like it's the World Cup. And I did that, and I went from 2 episodes to 25, I think I ended up doing.
Yeah.
They kept writing for me, but I improvised a lot, and I kept doing so. And at first people were put off by it. Some of the actors were like, who's this guy who thinks he's Brando, this idiot who came in for a tiny part? But when they watched the show, you better believe they all came back to me in the next season going, hey, man, you know, totally different vibe.
I should also just point out, Nick Jonas does a great job. And he's someone who, because of who he is, you know, he got a lot of shit for, you know, trying to become an actor. He's a talented young man.
I thought he did a wonderful job. There wasn't really a bad performance in that ensemble.
No, not in the slightest.
That's what, you know, if we were on Showtime or HBO, I think some of us would be holding trophies. But we were on DirecTV, which they were kind enough to make the show, but we never got that push, you know.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So. Now, you have dropped in on so many different comedy environments. Mm. The Reno 911 environment. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia environment. The Dan Harmon community environment. You've been in and out of all of those and many, many more. What's it like being the new kid just for a week or two?
You mean like being a guest on those like great comedy environments?
Yeah.
Early on it was, you know, they just treat you differently when you're not a known commodity in the industry. So early on, you know, you pop in and you meet people who treat you really well on those sets, like Yvette Nicole Brown and Ken Jeong were super sweet to me on Community. Charlie Day and, you know, Glenn Howerton were super sweet to me on Sunny. It's fun to pop in and play, but you also, it's such a tease because you're like telling in your head, you're like, I know I can do what you guys do. I'm just not there yet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what a joy early on to be on shows I watched. You know, I love getting to play with Key and Peele and getting to play with Charlie Day. And, you know, I recently reached out to my agent and said, hey, I love Tim Robinson's sketch show. I think you should leave. Would you pitch me for that, or tell them I'll literally serve sandwiches or hold a boom mic, you know, because it's, mm-hmm. I just love it. And it was very kind of Tim Robinson to reach out and say, hey, do you want to do this sketch? And I did that sketch for season 2. So my goal, even if I, in the best of dreams for me, if I dropped a bunch of weight and started doing what Chris Pratt does, and I'm in the next Jurassic Park movie and I'm got a chiseled jaw, even then I would still be doing Reno 911 and I Think You Should Leave and little stuff, because I it's such a joy. Why wouldn't you? Wouldn't it be cool if other actors did that? Wouldn't it be cool if, like, why the hell doesn't, you know, Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise decide to do a tiny, tiny bit in this. I guess Brad did it recently with The Lost City, and that was a joy to watch. And but I think actors shouldn't take themselves so seriously that they discount themselves from having a bit of fun.
No.
And they also rob people of their support, where they could really help the visibility of a lesser known show if they decided to go on it, you know.
Matt Damon does all kinds of random things. I love him for that. I love He's that cool. he has cameos in movies where he doesn't even look like himself.
Yeah.
Hell, Eurotrip. Still one of the best things he's ever done.
Yeah, it's about having fun, you know.
But that's it. It's supposed to be fun.
We'll put you on the spot then, just for a moment. If you could do a drop-in cameo in any film or franchise, what would it be?
Wow.
Not fair. We threw this at you.
Don't say we. I didn't do a damn thing.
I won't say the superhero world like DC Marvel, because I think I can play like a real character for that.
Sure.
Like a lead. But as far as dropping in, I would love to drop into the Fast and Furious franchise. I would love to just be like a weapons expert who has like two scenes opposite whomever,
right,
and just makes everybody laugh. But on television, I would love to do a cameo type thing on this. I love this show called The Chosen. It's like a biblical adaptation show.
Sure.
It's criminally underseen because it's just on an app, but I'm telling you, brilliant show. One of the only faith-based pieces of media that I actually co-sign. And I would love to play like Pontius Pilate or something in that show and come in and do an episode.
There's a fundamental question I meant to ask earlier, but we haven't had a linear conversation today. We've had a much more interesting one. What do you think from your church going experience informs your acting? And you talked about putting a little sliver of wood in your shoe to feel that discomfort. I wonder if any of that came about through your experiences in church and with your father being a pastor.
Interesting. Man, I mean, that might be a question for my sponsor or my therapist to answer, but I think if I could glean, well, one thing I can glean immediately is when you grow up in a church setting, it's kind of like a small town church setting is kind of like living in a Christopher Guest film. You co-mingle with so many people who are so well-meaning and have really good hearts, but maybe some of them are, you know, very quirky in some way, or undereducated but over talkative, you know, and you get to see so many different shades of person. That has been highly influential as far as me playing people in movies and TV, because I don't want to play a villain like a villain. I want to play a villain like a human. I don't want to play if I play a sort of a numbskull like Itania, it's got to be someone who has great convictions and self-belief still, and you know, their own reasoning or set of rules and values. So I think church helped me play grounded characters, made me a better actor from being around those types of people. But I would say from a point of like spirituality, I just gotta, life is, you know, they say in the Bible, they say the fear of the Lord is beginning of wisdom. They don't mean fear like, you know, as my buddy Chris Miller would say, it's not a scary clown in the window. That's not the fear or whatever. It's the healthy understanding that you are very insanely small and yet purposeful. God designed all people, in my limited opinion, God designed all people, loves all people, no matter what, and we are here for a purpose, though we're here for a blip. If you look at the timeline, we're not that important at all. Mm-hmm. But But we do have a purpose, and the three of us are doing it right now. It's part of our purpose of talking about what we love and inspiring other people and informing people. And hopefully when we log off here, there's other ways to love people and do something. And I think on a set, the worst version of me is thinking, I run this set. This is about me. I'm Richard Jewell. You need to such and such. Getting sober and being a self-professed Christian, I really have to keep, I never get to, it's, everything's penultimate. You're always trying to learn how do I become more humble and more loving while still doing my purpose. And people can praise you for the purpose, but once again, not saving lives. I'm making shows, making movies. That was such a jumbled, garbled sort of
way. Not at all.
Not the slightest.
I guess if I were to distill it though and reduce it to a phrase, I would say, if wisdom is the fear of the Lord, loving and adhering to other people is also a form of wisdom. I used to think being cool was doing shots with movie stars at the Chateau Marmont, and I did that. But now I think I'm redefining cool. I think being cool is being kind and accountable. That's real cool. Mm-hmm. Everything else is perception and is pretty wasteful.
Yeah. I mean, but entertainment is something. And making people laugh. That's my favorite thing in the world is to make people laugh. That's my favorite thing.
It's awesome. It's undersold. It's underappreciated, I think. Well, Jesse and I talk about this a lot. Escapism gets a bad rap. Like it's a dirty word.
If a movie is a popcorn movie, it's light and it's fun and it's not an award film, whatever. If you enjoy something and it makes you laugh and it makes you happy,
yeah,
why do you care? And why is that somehow less valuable than a Martin Scorsese, very serious? No, you know, I love to laugh. I love to have a good time. I love a distraction, you know,
and taking people away from their lives for a couple of hours and giving them an experience, whether it's a provocative experience or a happy experience, that's a very high achievement.
It ain't nothing.
Well, keep in mind, why do people, and I think these folks who say Marvel movies or whatever, they are less than, we should be more hyper concerned and focused on making these adult dramas. One, this is still a business. It's the movie TV business. We're trying to make money.
Yeah.
So if you can make dramas that make us all want to flock to the theater, then cool. Go make those and you'll get more attention. The onus is on you.
Yeah.
The other issue is it's about ego with a lot of these auteurs. Some of them are kind of looking at their body of work and they're like, well, why am I not getting talked about more? Why am I not getting the money I feel I deserve? But you watch these movies and it's like Judd Apatow and Martin Scorsese. These guys are making 3-hour movies.
Yeah.
They're getting like $50 to $200 million budgets. And it's like, what the hell else do you want, dude? Like you got your stuff. Like, their opinions matter and we like hearing from them. But like, at the end of the day, it's still a competition. And if you want to be talked about in the same ether, you better start performing at the same level. Period. End of story.
Yeah. People tease my dad because one of his main complaints with almost every movie is that it's too long. To which I say, but they are. So.
Yeah. Well, this conversation has flown by.
Yeah.
And Paul, thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me. This was fun. We'll do it again. Let's wait till I have something really big coming out. We'll do it again.
But and just real quick again, talk about your music because your publicist was very proud of you for this. And she said, please make sure he talks about his music.
I'll just quickly say I love hip hop. I'm a huge fan of Kendrick Lamar, Chance the Rapper, Run the Jewels.
Sure.
And I just was inspired to try to make music the same way Kevin Bacon or Jeff Daniels pluck a guitar. The name I go under is Signet Ringer, S-I-G-N-E-T, Ringer, and Murder for Hire, H-I-G-H-E-R, Murder for Hire is the EP. It's out now on Spotify and Apple Music, and I'll probably be dropping another EP this autumn before trying to put out an album in 2023 or 2024.
That's awesome. Well done.
Good.
That's exciting.
We wish you every success.
Yeah. Leonard's really into rap. So I can only imagine, you know, got those subwoofers.
It's just another character, right?
Of course.
It's very theatrical, and there's levity and self-deprecation laced throughout. And I think people who like my acting will weirdly take to the music, even if they're not a fan of hip hop. I think they'll like it.
That's awesome.
Well, thank you for having me. God bless you too. And
thank you, sir.
Thanks for promoting the show by talking about it. It means a lot to us.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant show. Truly. It's a brilliant show.
And that show is Blackbird.
Blackbird.
Playing on Apple Plus. Apple Plus television. And it gets confusing with all of these.
So many streaming services.
New streaming. Well, they're not new, but you can't subscribe to them all.
No.
And it's tough. But a show like this, 6 1-hour installments, it's worth paying for.
It's so well done. It's so well written. The acting, Taron Egerton is really special. He's really got that it.
And it gives us a last
Ray Liotta.
Look at Ray Liotta,
who is also fantastic in this. No surprise, but he's so good.
Yeah.
Man, well, it's so nice to finally get to talk to Paul, because I am a fan of his and I've been watching him now for several years. And it is exciting to see what he's going to do next.
Yep.
And it is very, you got to love that he's got everything planned ahead, wants to make a feature film, and he seems like someone who's going to get that done.
Yeah. I bet he will.
Yeah. He's going to make it happen. Anyway, thank you guys as always for joining us. You can follow me and the Mr. Malton. I'm at Jesse Malton. He's at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. He's also on Facebook. You can go to our YouTube channel, Malton on Movies. We do a live stream every Sunday. And there's always the Maltreon Patreon.
Patreon.com/Malton on Movies. And that's where you can support what we do and help us to keep doing it.
And we're very, very grateful.
And we are. We have different ways of showing thanks. Go to patreon.com/Malton on Movies. And we will see you next time. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.